Court Calls 13-21-00412-CV.
May it please court. Good afternoon. I wanted to start out, and it's a, you kind of stole my thunder there a little bit, but I did want, on behalf of both parties and I guess the local bar, that we appreciate the opportunity to present orally and to have oral argument. I know that the court is inundated with all kinds of opinions, and sometimes oral argument may seem a little frustrating, but it does give us an opportunity to communicate a little better what we think are some of the more important points of our area. So I do appreciate it on behalf of both counsel. I'm sure counsel for the appellee is equally grateful. So thank you for that opportunity. Your Honor, we're here on interlocutory appeal, obviously, of a denial of a pleaded jurisdiction at the trial court level. And what I'd like to do is kind of give you a little bit of factual background, if you'll permit me just a moment, to kind of set the stage of what this was about, and then give you the legal basis for why we're here and why we're having of the opinion that there's no jurisdiction at the trial court level to hear this case, and that way it should now be dismissed. So basically, we represent the Edinburgh CISD. This is a case brought by a former assistant principal of the school. There was an unfortunate set of circumstances in which a nude selfie photograph of this principal was disseminated amongst student body, amongst parents and the community there in Edinburgh. So after that, the district determined that that would be a direct interference with the principal's ability to fulfill her duties. So a separation of employment naturally resulted from that, and she was terminated from her position. Subsequent to that, though, she challenged the rulings by the district and the termination through a hearing with an independent hearing examiner, going through a Commissioner of Education challenge. Now, in that, it's the defendant's position that throughout that proceedings, and this, some of this might sound familiar, and I'll explain, because part of this has already been brought before this court through that proceedings, not through the litigation you see here before you. But this court has actually already issued some rulings on these very facts, so they may seem a little familiar. But there was a Commissioner of Education challenge, and at that hearing, it's the defendant's position that they had an adequate opportunity to litigate the circumstances of her termination in general. And what do I mean by that is that process administratively involved discovery, involved depositions. Mrs. Sparsa, of course, was represented by counsel. They had a full-blown examination hearing. It was about 9 hours long. At that hearing, there was live testimony provided by six different witnesses with cross-examination, including the plaintiff. They invoked a rule, just like you would in a normal court proceeding. Mrs. Sparsa was able to file a motion for summary judgment, a motion to exclude evidence. There was a motion to dismiss that was heard. So the matter was litigated almost in a mini-trial type situation, and the challenge was that the district's determination of termination was wrongful, was unlawful. That was the subject matter of what was being done.
Counsel, I'm going to interrupt you. And I had the benefit of being on the other panel. I don't think the rest of the panel was. I think it was a different makeup.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But how was the issue of pretext fully and fairly litigated in this proceeding that you're talking about, the commissioner's proceeding?
Fair question. Jumping ahead through my facts here.
Okay, take your time.
No, I want to address.
As long as you get to it at some point. My question in my mind.
And you know, and that's why when I was developing how to present this matter, I couldn't find a better way than to say, look, there's some groundwork stuff that kind of leads from A equals B equals C, and then it comes together. But I will address your question specifically. And when it comes down to whether or not there was a pretext argument, it depends on what the determinations by this very court during the proceeding, what was established, what was said, what was mandated. I believe Your Honor wrote a concurring opinion in that particular matter. And then with respect to the findings and rulings of this very court here, we believe that those are binding and on the current litigation, which is why we've said that most of that has been collaterally stopped. When you're talking about a pretextual type situation, that implies that the rationale or the reason for the legitimate non-discriminatory reason is somehow false, egregious, erroneous, improper, something that agreed. Well, this Court of Appeals determined that no, those actually underlying facts that supported the termination were not unlawful, were not egregious, were reasonable. Well, if they're reasonable and they're not egregious and not unlawful, they can't be pretextual. But moving, if that answers your question, Jenny, but I'll try
to. There was no evidence that was presented to the commissioner in that proceeding regarding whether Esparza was disciplined differently or disparately than her other male colleagues. I don't recall in the commissioner's findings making any reference or any argument about, you know, these other principals are doing improper things and they're being treated differently.
But an adequate opportunity to bring that up should they have chosen to do so or litigate it in whatever fashion they wish, That was available.
Okay.
So, and there's a subsequent, there's another opinion I'm going to talk about in a minute. There was a Port Isabel opinion that came out of this court as well. Okay. And that one is right on point for that exact same okay. argument that you're talking about. So, if but just, and I know you guys are somewhat familiar with the facts of the case, but essentially the case proceeded after that point. They challenged the ruling by the district court. They appealed that to the school board. School board appeals it. And then they go to the Commissioner of Education. The Commissioner of Education concludes that this circumstance involving this nude publication, this nude photograph, diminished her capacity to perform a role as a principal. Okay, so at that point, Esparza challenged that. Commission went back to the district court. The district court overturned. At that point, the district appealed it to the 13th Court of Appeals, which is where it came here. Now, at this Court of Appeals, right, the opinion that was rendered here, there are some very specific findings that I think are very pertinent to the civil litigation that, that I'm a part of at the trial court level now. And in particular, this opinion authored by Justice Contreras, the 13th court here says, it was reasonable for the school board to infer from the escalating media coverage and the fact that the photo had gone viral that the disruption and distraction would continue to interfere with her ability to effectively perform her job duties. That's kind of etched in stone. That's already a finding. It's already been determined. We can't undo that. It's been judicially determined. This opinion was attempted to be appealed beyond it. Writ was denied, so it is set in stone. Subsequent, the court also indicated that it's reasonable to conclude that based on the nature of the employment, a principal in charge of a school caring for teenage children, the nature of the photo, voluntarily taken naked photograph, and the group that circulated the picture, students, teachers, and the school community, that the distraction would continue to increase, media attention and parental inquiries and complaints would persist and increase, and that would impair Esparza's future effectiveness. The reason the court was evaluating these issues is because the subject of the genuineness of her termination was that issue. Now, how they decide or what type of positions to take or evidence to submit, as long as they have an adequate opportunity to present what they need to present, then the law says, then you've litigated, you've had your day in court. Now, the court concluded, this court concluded by saying that the commissioner's decision was supported by substantial evidence. It was not erroneous. And the commissioner did not err when he implicitly concluded that ECISD's decision was not arbitrary, was not capricious, and was not unlawful. So if I were to take an alternative position at the trial court and say, wait, this was discriminatory. Well, I can't have it be discriminatory and not unlawful, because discriminatory is unlawful. It couldn't have been capricious or arbitrary. It had a reasonable basis that had the opportunity to be litigated. This fact was all litigated and measured through this administrative proceeding, and it went all the way through the Court of Appeals. This wasn't just a simple trial court level that never got an opportunity to be challenged.
Well, so, but this matter, this charge of discrimination had been filed, you know, previous to the commissioner's proceeding, had it not? It, with the, what is it, TWC?
Which section. means that very same argument, I was fired for this reason, that reason, this reason, that reason, not because of some justifiable one, was readily available for an adequate opportunity to challenge the litigation.
But don't they have exclusive jurisdiction?
In this particular, because we're dealing with an educator and they have a Commissioner of Education proceedings, no, they chose to pursue the administrative procedure. The Commissioner of Education could have told us to hire her back. And if this Court of Appeals, it was challenged, this Court of Appeals said, yes, you hire her back, we'd hire her back. There wouldn't have been litigation to challenge that issue. It becomes a final administrative decision. So they have binding authority.
Under the Texas Commission on Human Rights or whatever mm-hmm. that entity is, that you weren't supposed to even talk about discrimination until they gave you the right to sue. How does that work?
If you're challenging it in the form of a petition, Your Honor, like if you're actually going to initiate litigation, you can't actually file your suit until you have exhausted that administrative remedy. But that administrative remedy is not required, obviously, to pursue the Commissioner of Education appeal, which was done here. Okay. At the Commissioner of Education appeal matter here, that commissioner has a lot of power. He can make decisions and render judgment just the way a trial court could. So some litigants choose to pursue that appeal strictly and live by those rules, and that's where it is. And the point is not to create duplicative litigation. It's to give, if you're going to pursue that path, that the commissioner has full authority to grant you what you need. But to perhaps a better way of illustrating this, if we're talking about, there's a case, and actually I think, let's see who this was, if I'm not mistaken, I think Justice Longoria authored this opinion actually. It was an opinion, it was called Point Isabel ISD versus Hernandez.
That okay? was mine, yes.
It is almost, I probably couldn't find a case that is more on point or more similar to the circumstances we have here. In that case, you had an employee of the school district that was non-renewed. And As a result of that, she appealed her decision to the Commission of Education. She took it to the same path that this plaintiff did. The commissioner found substantial evidence to support the district's decision to non-renew. She appealed to the district court. The district court upheld it. Then she filed a complaint with Texas Workforce Commission, right, alleging age discrimination. She filed a lawsuit about it. It rendered up into an appeal, and they challenged jurisdiction just like we did here. So at the 13th Court of Appeals level here, the decision read as follows. And this was in 2019, I believe. The 13th Court of Appeals determined that the trial court lacked jurisdiction to hear plaintiff's claims alleged in the Texas Workforce Commission complaint because it had already been litigated. Here's the actual notations from the court's opinion itself. Hernandez argues that because she did not raise age discrimination or retaliation prior to the underlying suit, her claims have not been fully and fairly adjudicated. Same, similar as here. And therefore, collateral estoppel cannot apply. While Hernandez contends that she is raising new issues that have not been adjudicated, her complaints of age discrimination and retaliation, and this is the key language here, arise out of the same set of facts and are premised on the issue of non-renewal of her contract. In other words, arise out of the same set of facts and are premised on the issue of termination or loss of your position of employment.
Well, I was also on that panel.
You were?
It seems like I've been on both panels. And my recollection is that we did not address the pretextual component of the burden-shifting analysis in the Point Isabel case. Perhaps it, because it was not, wasn't argued.
You didn't have to.
But
you didn't have to. And the reason you didn't have to is because the question there and the question today was jurisdiction. You know, if when you're a governmental entity, there's only so many ways you can sue a governmental entity. The legislature has put out certain statutes that waive jurisdiction. Obviously, we know that. We talked about the EEOC complaints a moment ago, the Labor Code, Texas Commission on Human Rights Act, things of that nature. So the first step at the trial court level is, do you have jurisdiction to hear this in the first place? We heard a little bit of that in the other argument opinion, but this is a little more specific, okay? It's very, very specific. So in this situation here, in order for the trial court to have jurisdiction, there couldn't have been prior determinations by an appellate court. In other words, I can't go to trial and then litigate a matter and then have a finding that the termination was unlawful, set it before this court of appeals to appeal that judgment and tell this court, you've already said it was lawful before, but I'm here again to ask you again if you'll just repeat what you said last time, because you've seen all the facts, you've had a full record, they had a fair opportunity to litigate, this went before the Commission of Education, and there's been findings that have made. It's a strange procedural, unfortunate situation, but this has already gone down its path, and this is like a second bite at the apple at the district court level. Your opinion in the Port Isabel case essentially establishes you don't get a second bite at the apple. This is something that you had a fair opportunity to litigate. You should have had it brought in this particular challenge any way you say fit, and there was a finding and a determination. So to go back and try to litigate, in this case, it's not age discrimination like in Port Isabel, it's gender discrimination, but it's the same principles. So if we look
if we go ahead and interpret Point Isabel,
yes,
you know, as completely barring a discrimination claim in this case, would we then not be collapsing issue preclusion and collateral estoppel into a claim preclusion res judicata? Isn't that what we would?
No, because we're no, respectfully.
Okay.
Because we're talking about triggering jurisdiction, and if you're not going to get there at the end of the day to trigger jurisdiction, you're either there or you're not. In this scenario here, no matter what you do, in light of this former proceeding and opinion, you can't get there. It's impossible to undo what has already been established by this court. And this court's determination, this court's findings, that diminished her capacity to perform, she couldn't effectively perform her duties, impaired future effectiveness, was not unlawful, was not arbitrary, was not capricious. It's already been adjudicated. And so at the trial court level, they're asking the school district to adjudicate it all over again, just like they did in the Port Isabel case. In the Port Isabel case, the conclusion here was Texas law applies collateral estoppel to administrative agency orders when the agency is acting in a judicial capacity, like the Commissioner of Education, and resolves disputed issues of fact properly before it when the parties have had an adequate opportunity to litigate. So it couldn't be any more similar. I read an opinion one time that says sometimes the law looks a little strange, but the law is the law, and we have to kind of follow it. This fits right into the same box that the Port Isabel case had. And of course, by a biased opinion, I believe that was the proper result given the fact that they had an opportunity to litigate. And keep in mind, too, in this particular, you not only had an opportunity to litigate, it was litigated. There were full-blown cross-examinations. There were witnesses. There was discovery. There were dispositive motions being resolved. They were represented by counsel. It was a full-blown proceeding. So in our humble opinion, because of the results that happened in that administrative opinion that's already been appealed here, they don't have jurisdiction to proceed and do this all over again in the trial court level. That would be my position at this point. Right on time.
I love that little plot.
May it please the court. I can't really agree with pretty much anything Mr. Garza has said today, because none of what he is contending makes any sense. And it doesn't make sense because of one reason, or actually just various, but the best one is the only way Cristina Esparza could bring a claim for gender discrimination under the TCHRA is by filing a claim with the Texas Workforce Commission Civil Rights Division. It's the only way you can do it. If she would have brought these claims in the administrative proceeding where she was terminated for good cause or not good cause, that was the issue. Was there good cause? If she did that there and we say, hey, wait a minute, we're bringing the gender discrimination claim in front of the commissioner, in front of the school board, they're gonna say, wait a minute, guys, judge, you have to dismiss her case because she didn't exhaust her administrative remedies through the TWC. Dismiss it. And there is 1,000,000,000,000,000,000 cases that say, if you don't exhaust your administrative remedies through the TWC, you cannot have a claim of any type of discrimination under the TCHRA. That's it.
But how do you distinguish then the Point Isabel case?
Well, honestly, Your Honor, and this is my humble opinion, the attorney for that plaintiff, I don't think he did his job. I think they just waived all those arguments. He just didn't raise them. And I think that's why it's like that. And so this court doesn't have the duty to be a advocate for either side. And so if you don't raise it, you waive it. I get it. That's what I think happened there. But it's not going to happen in this case. And it didn't happen in this case. Because if Mr. Garza is right, then you would have the Commissioner of Education using, and I have to talk about this for a second. The Commissioner of Education is charged with making findings under a substantial evidentiary standard, which is lower than preponderance of the evidence standard. So, in essence, any gender discrimination claim brought in district court has to be, or in county court, that's going to be under a preponderance of the evidence standard. And so, right there, I'm giving you an issue right there that would not only defy logic, in my opinion, but it would be erroneous to apply a substantial evidence standard to a gender discrimination claim. I don't think it's never been done before. You can't do that. And aside and apart from that, Your Honors, I cited in my brief, it's the Port Arthur case. The Port Arthur case is very, very significant because it says that the Commissioner of Education only has exclusive jurisdiction over the school laws of the state. And it specifically holds that the Commissioner of Education does not have jurisdiction over claims under the TCHRA. So what Mr. Garza is saying is like, well, you know what? No, the Commissioner of Education, he can rule on everything. He can rule on whether there's good cause under the contract, and he can also make gender discrimination determinations under a substantial evidence standard, but not preponderance of the evidence. You can't do that. You're never going to find a case that says that the Commissioner of Education can sit like a district court does, and he can use substantial evidence for the Chapter 21 good cause for the contract termination case, but then use preponderance of the evidence standard for gender discrimination, even if it was brought before him. He can't do that. There's no case law that's ever going to say that he can do that. It doesn't exist. And so I'm going to go back to my first point, or the biggest thing. The only way Cristina Esparza could have brought her gender discrimination claims is by following what the procedural aspect of the law requires, which is you file your claim of discrimination with the Texas Workforce Commission. Then they go through their process and do their investigation, and they give you a right to sue letter. Then they give you X amount of time to file the suit. Then you file the suit, and then that's where the case goes. That's exactly what she did. Now, the other thing that I don't understand what Mr. Garza is saying is that he's talking about, well, they said it was lawful and everything's okay. No, nothing. It's further from the truth. That's not what happened. The only thing that the Commissioner of Education was looking at was one thing. Is there good cause or is there not good cause? That's it. Those are the only facts or the only issue for determination before him. That's it. And I'm going to read you on page 21 of Mr. Garza's brief. He says, Esparza failed to raise any issue with regard to the alleged gender discrimination, as there is no reference made to any gender discrimination in the hearing transcript. And he's talking about the administrative trial. I would agree with that. That is true. There was never a gender discrimination claim made before the Commissioner of Education, ever. And so he's arguing collateral estoppel. And the reason that this is so important is because collateral estoppel only applies to claims that are actually litigated. He's asking for res judicata relief. Res judicata says, if you take something before a court of competent jurisdiction and obtain a ruling, you're gonna get rid of not only the claims that you actually litigated, but all the claims that you could have litigated. He's not arguing res judicata. If you read my brief, it says that in my opinion, you can't even get res judicata either, because there was never any entity or court with competent jurisdiction over her gender discrimination claims. And there could not be. It's an impossibility. And the reason that it's impossible is because she can only bring that or start the process of obtaining or bringing, excuse me, a gender discrimination claim if she goes through the TWC first. So then, it's a very simple thing to me. It may seem complicated, but it's not. It's not, because if you follow the law, which is you have to go through the TWC to file your gender discrimination claim, then they give you your right to sue letter, and then you sue, and then there you go. Okay. That's what happened here. And the issue with respect to her contract of employment is only with respect, it's a very narrow track. That's the only thing that she can do. She can't bring other claims in there at the same time. Now, there are other cases where plaintiffs do that, and I guess they do it. I don't know why they do it. It doesn't make sense to me that they did it. But I'm just thinking that the law says that the Commission of Education only has exclusive jurisdiction over the school laws of Texas, and the Port Arthur case says the Commission of Education does not have jurisdiction over TCHRA claims. So if that's true, then Ms. Esparza did the only thing she could do under the circumstances. And so res judicata, that he did not, that the school district has not pled that. I'm saying it doesn't apply anyway. But he's asking, what he's trying to say is Esparza had a fair opportunity to litigate all the claims that she had, and she didn't litigate the gender discrimination claims. What he's saying is you should bar not only claims that she litigated, but the claims that she should have litigated. That's res judicata. He did not plead that. He pled collateral estoppel. Collateral estoppel issue preclusion only takes care of claims that are actually litigated. And he admits on page 21 of his brief that she didn't litigate any gender discrimination claims. The case is over. That's what I think. That's just the tip of the iceberg. But really, the other thing that I just believe is the most important thing, probably in terms of what the merits of the case talk about, is even if Esparza were to agree, and she does not, but even if she was to agree, you know what? They had good cause to terminate the contract. We can take that position, and she still wouldn't lose her ability to bring a mixed motive McDonnell Douglas circumstantial evidence gender discrimination claim against the school district. That's because She brings her prima facie case. Then the burden shifts to the defendant to show that there was a legitimate reason. And he's saying, well, we got our legitimate reason, we win. Well, that doesn't where the analysis does not stop there. Then it says, if the defendant proffers a legitimate reason for the adverse employment action, the burden shifts to the plaintiff to show one of two things. Number one, the reason stated by the employer was a pretext for discrimination, or the defendant's reason, while true, was only one reason for its conduct, and discrimination is another motivating factor. That's a mixed motive case under the McDonnell Douglas. And I cited Michael versus City of Dallas, 314 Southwest 3rd, 689. It's a Dallas Court of Appeals case. And I like that case because it breaks down the law real nice. And it tells you that this is the analysis that you have to go through if you bring a gender discrimination claim like she has. And so Mr. Garza's argument stopped right there where he has the first burden shift, which says, well, we showed a legitimate reason. The commissioner said it was a good reason. The Court of Appeals agreed that it was a good reason. That does not stop the analysis. The law keeps going. The burden shifts back to the plaintiff. And what I'm saying is that there's no evidence. It wasn't even raised. It wasn't briefed. There's nothing in the record that shows that Esparza would be precluded from showing that the defendant's reason, while true, was only one reason for its conduct, and discrimination is another motivating factor.
Yeah, my recollection was, and the court's analysis was, the basis is basically what transpired basically impaired her ability to do her job. Not that she wasn't qualified to do her job, but basically that the publicity and everything surrounding it, but did not preclude, like you said, this other pretext, you know, like what you all are arguing, that was just one of the reasons, but there were non-discriminatory reasons, but there were also discriminatory reasons.
That is correct. Because she, and I mean, that's just, yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right. But one more argument, I think it's fairly persuasive, okay? In plea to the jurisdiction jurisprudence, you have to take as true everything that the plaintiff alleges. She alleged all of the specific prima facie case elements. She was a member of a protected class, she was qualified, there was adverse employment action against her, she was terminated, and she was replaced by someone of the opposite class. She pled all that. There's no facts that the school district brought to the trial court to say, no, that's wrong. And even if he did, you would have a fact question which would preclude the court granting the plea to the jurisdiction. So if you take the first thing that I said, which is, you know, you can't mix and match these two things. You cannot do it. Because if this court rules and agrees with Mr. Garza, then you're going to say that a person in Mrs. Esparza's position would have to bring all of the claims that she has in front of the Commissioner of Education. And it doesn't, you don't have to listen to the TWC. You don't have to file anything with the TWC. You don't have to make a charge of discrimination. You don't have to do any of it. You just go take it in front of the commissioner. When she tries to say, okay, commissioner, award me relief under the TCHRA, how does the commissioner of education have authority to do that? He doesn't. He has no authority to do it. The damages that you can get under an employment claim are different than the damages that you can receive from Chapter 21 of the Education Code. He can't account for that because it doesn't make any sense. Because the statutes are, there are two different tracks here. One is, was there good cause to terminate her contract? That's been litigated. We're not relitigating that. We're relitigating, was she a victim of gender discrimination? And none of the facts that he pled, none of the things he's offered into evidence, preclude us from saying, okay, fine, you may have had a legitimate reason, but gender discrimination was another motivating factor. He's done nothing to say you can't do that. The law lets me do it. And that's what we intend to do. But The court here has jurisdiction over the claim, over Ms. Esparza's claims, because he cannot negate any of the things that I just told you, that she has the ability under the law, under McDonnell Douglas, to prove for a gender discrimination claim.
And there was no evidence in front of the commissioner that she was not qualified, correct?
Well, no, that wasn't even at the, there was not even, that wasn't even an issue. I mean, you know, one thing that I want to make sure the court's aware of is that, and this is on it's a clerk's record 150. There's evidence from the superintendent that his testimony, where we questioned him, he admitted that even while this photo was in circulation and despite the superintendent having knowledge of this photograph being circulated, that she was still being considered for a promotion at the time. He testified to that. That's clerk's record 150, okay? And so, I mean, at the very least, you'd have a fact issue about whether or not she's qualified if they're still trying to promote her during the time that this photograph is in circulation. But yes, to answer the question, Your Honor, there was the issue as to whether she was qualified or not was not ever at issue. She is qualified. She'd been an employee for 14 years. She had exemplary marks for everything. I mean, she was even being considered for promotion during the time that this particular photograph is in circulation. And so there's nothing that Mr. Garza or the district have provided to say, well, she's not qualified. They're just saying, look, you know what? This is bad. This looks real bad. We have to get rid of you. I'm sorry. It looks bad. And you know, this court says, look, you know, if the school district believes that it's bad for the community, that's what the school board's for. I get it. But we're not here on that case. We're here on the gender discrimination case under the McDonnell Douglas standard that we have a right to bring. And the district has not negated any of the facts that are required to say that I can't bring that. So the court has jurisdiction to make a ruling as to whether or not gender discrimination has occurred. She's pled her prima facie case. And I think this qualification issue that Mr. Garza is trying to talk about, he's trying to say that because this was a distraction or that she may have been ineffective, that's not equivalent to being qualified for the job. I mean, she's master's degree level. She'd been working for the district for 14 years. She got exemplary marks every time that she was evaluated. There's nothing that they've submitted negates any of those facts. And there's nothing that he submitted at the trial court or on the record in this case that would support that claim. So that's kind of a non-issue. But really, I think, you know, there's three reasons, and I'll conclude, but he's requesting relief that only res judicata can provide, and he didn't plead res judicata. So this is an easy one. It's easy. Number two, there's no way that Christina Esparza could have brought her gender discrimination claims before the Commissioner of Education. There's no way. Otherwise, you just say, okay, you know what, forget about the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act. We don't have to worry about the procedural aspects of that. Just say whatever you need to say to the commissioner. It's okay. Go ahead. He can grant you relief, by the way, just like a district court could do. No. You can't mix that. And aside and apart from that, the other due process problem is the Commissioner of Education would be tasked with using preponderance of the evidence standard and substantial evidence at the same time. You can't do that. He doesn't have the power to do that. And Mr. Garza can't come up here and tell you that the Commissioner of Education can use preponderance of the evidence standard for a gender discrimination claim while simultaneously using substantial evidence for her Chapter 21 claim as to whether good cause to terminate her contract existed or not. But for those reasons, Your Honors, we request that you affirm the trial court's judgment in denying the plea to the jurisdiction. And we request that you remand us for further proceedings before the trial court. Thank you.
May I proceed? You know, I think the point that's lost here is there's no requirement that Mrs. Esparza pursue a Commissioner of Education appeal. She didn't have to do that. She could have filed a TWC complaint right off the bat and pursued whatever claim she wished to do so. But when you do choose to pursue an administrative appeal, you abide by that process and the relief that is provided by that particular process, which involves reinstatement, back wages, all the kinds of things that you would expect in that type of scenario.
Well, but they're not mutually exclusive either. She can do both.
Unless, no, if you choose the path of the Commissioner of Education, and this is, you would have to overturn the Hernandez opinion to controvert what I'm about to say, which is if you choose the Commissioner of Education appeal opinion, right, and it goes all the way through the process, as long as it's determined that you had an adequate opportunity to litigate your issues, you could have talked about whatever you want to talk about. Did you get a hearing? Were you represented by counsel? Were you afforded an opportunity to be heard? Did you follow your process? Did you have an appellate process? Could you go to the district court if you didn't like your ruling? Could you go to the 13th Court of Appeals if you didn't like your ruling? All that happened here. Okay, so.
But in Point Isabel, I believe maybe the difference is they brought everything to the Commissioner of Education. They brought they brought all those other causes of action to him.
In Port Isabel, what she said, her assertion was she didn't raise age discrimination or retaliation prior to the underlying suit. So she hadn't really raised it or litigated it. And that's why that case is so similar to this one. If you look at them side by side, right, if you look at how the cases shook out, you know, in the Hernandez case, she challenged the loss of her job. That's what happened here. In the Hernandez case, the Point Isabel case, to appeal to the Commissioner of Education, that happened here. In the Point Isabel case, had an adequate opportunity to fully and fairly litigate the loss of her job. That's undisputed as well. The commissioner issued findings of facts and conclusions of law, just like happened here. They filed a subsequent claim alleging the loss of a job was because of discrimination. That's exactly what happened here. But in the Hernandez case, at the 13th Court of Appeals case, they said no. And this is, you know, you've heard collateral estoppel versus res judicata. This is, Justice Longoria, this is right out of the opinion. And I don't disagree with it, and I think it is the law of the land that needs to be upheld. But this is what it says. You know, at the conclusion of talking about premised on the same facts for the non-renewal, Texas law applies collateral estoppel to administrative agency orders when the agency is acting in a judicial capacity, such as the Commissioner of Education, and resolves disputed issues of fact properly before it when the parties have had an adequate opportunity to litigate. So this isn't about whether or not you brought a gender claim or didn't bring one. Could you have argued that your termination was not based on the legitimate grounds that the district puts forward? You could have said anything. You could have said it's discrimination. You could have said it was a wrong evaluation. You could have said it was, for whatever reason you choose to litigate, it's wide open for what you choose to do. So
counsel, yes. Are you suggesting that the commissioner could have properly considered Ms. Espadasa's gender discrimination
absolutely
claim prior to receiving her right to sue letter?
Absolutely, absolutely. You see, the Commissioner of Education could have evaluated whatever rationale you want to bring in your defense to say you were terminated unlawfully, improperly, whatever you want to do. Now, you don't have to pursue that path at all. You don't have to live by what the commissioner's ruling is. You can choose not to pursue that Chapter 21 process and just go straight into the Code of Division. I have had other cases, I've litigated, I've actually appealed it in this court, and I've lost on that, so I know that answer's correct, okay? There's a difference between pursuing under the Texas Workforce Commission claims and the Education Code. But in this scenario here, it followed the exact same path as the Hernandez case, and the conclusion of the Hernandez case was, you had a fair opportunity to litigate this matter if you had chosen to do so. Therefore, you can't just go back and do it all over again, especially in light of the findings of fact that have been approved and that have been established as a matter of law. If you put the opinion side by side, it's virtually impossible to reach the conclusion that they're seeking.
But counsel, I don't recall anything about this this pretext argument being made at all in the other case. This is the new way of, that they're raising it, this whole thing and this whole argument, the McDougal case, I believe, or whatever that other case is, where it talks about there could be dual reasons. You know, one's a pretext reason, and there could be dual reasons. And so, to me, that distinguishes it. It's not that we would have to overturn our precedent. We could distinguish it, could we not, and say that this is based on, you know, this issue of pretext, which now shifts, has a burden shifting, you know, analysis.
Pretext wasn't evaluated in the Hernandez case either. But the real issue that this court has wrestled with, the case law supports, and that the opinion came down from that Hernandez case, is whether they had an adequate opportunity to discuss those issues if they wish. When you say something is pretextual, what you're saying is, It's false. It's wrong. It's illegal. I should still be working here. You had no good, valid reason to terminate me. This is all based on something malicious or whatever you want to say. However, we put that in a box called pretext, right? Pretextual. But what you're asserting is my termination was unlawful. It was not legitimate the way the district has purported to be, which was the nude photograph that was circulated around the community. So if they have the adequate opportunity to present their case to the Commissioner of Education, then the case law says you've had your fair and full opportunity to litigate. You can't litigate it all over again and second guess everything that just happened in this entire proceeding that took, you know, better part of a couple of years probably and multiple appeals.
But don't you think that's creating a tension between the labor code and the education code, where you're basically saying if you follow this route, your remedies under the labor code, then you're somehow, that's sort of predicted, or that's, you know, you're precluding from seeking remedies under, you know, the labor code.
The legislature contemplated that. That's why they put forth the Chapter 21 proceedings, to make it more efficient for administrators, because the process, number one, doesn't take as long as traditionally would be in the other proceedings. But it was to provide an alternative avenue given through a Commissioner of Education with appellate review potential in there if you don't like the way it comes out on your angle. So it was, that whole process was designed to streamline that process for educators when they're challenging the termination of their contracts. And quite frankly, if we get really down into the nitty-gritty of it, it's because there are times in which a school district has to provide notice to an employee of when they're going to be non-renewed. That happens a couple of months before the end of the contract. So in order for them to be able to try to get a result before the following school year and they get back to work, they want to streamline that process. That's where the Chapter 21 came into play. So I think they actually contemplated that literally when they were giving certain authorities to the commissioner to address those issues.
It'll be under submission, counselors. Oh. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It kind of kept you longer than we
apologize.